Today we're in Meth 2.0 world. Please introduce yourself. I remember you from the BCL team interview.
Yes, my name is Oleg Lubovich, and I've been working on meth. And I also evidently called meth the wrong thing then, because I called Microsoft Extensibility Framework.
Ooh.
Yes, it's Managed Extensibility Framework, and this is...
I'm Kevin Ransom, and I also work on meth.
Okay.
When I started working on meth, it was the Microsoft Extensibility Framework, but apparently it's been renamed.
It has been renamed.
Unbeknownst to both of us.
Okay, so it's only for managed code.
Yes.
I don't think I've ever done a Channel 9 video on MEF, even MEF 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of educate me and other people out there who might not know what it is exactly, now that we know what it's called.
Well, the Microsoft, the Managed Extensibility Framework, is for creating extensible apps in managed code.
Okay.
Typically, developers write apps, and often when they're writing those apps, they want to leave hooks in them for their customers to complete the app, provide their own application-specific logic. For instance, FXCOP might want to allow you to add new rules when checking out the code. And that's what MEF is primarily aimed at.
Excellent.
One thing to mention is, which it has to do with the history of MEF, which actually reflects a lot on what it is today,
mm-hmm.
is that during the previous release, the Dev 10, Visual Studio was revitalizing their ecosystem, and as a result, it was re-implementing some of the parts of itself in managed code, the editor being one of them. It was an important investment for them. And they did and one of the value props of that was extensibility system. And so that the editors can be easily extensible. And you can see demos with them showing embedding YouTube videos in their common blocks and stuff like that. How useful that is, and it's a different question, but it's very impressive. And so they needed a very fine-grained extensibility model for that. And some of the interesting requirements that impose on the extensibility model, for example, the pervasive delay loading of everything and the very finely grained defined contracts and all this stuff is that all has influenced MEF to a huge degree because they're using MEF for that purpose.
And to be clear, you can see MEF on the vSIP extensibility interface. Quite often you're shoving imports and exports on your Visual Studio add-ins.
Excellent. Now, the Visual Studio add-ins can be written in managed code.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically editor extensions.
Editor extensions.
And this release, I believe, they're opening more of Visual Studio into the same model. I don't actually remember which ones at this point, and which ones are public and which ones are not, so I'm just going to be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that their model is to, as time goes on, to expand it. And they have introduced what they call VSIX, VSIX model, which is based entirely on MEF.
Excellent. Now, MEF 2.0 is your latest release coming out. People can play with it today in the developer preview, the Visual Studio 11 developer preview, yes?
And it's also out in CodeFlex, which we've been releasing every few months.
Excellent, man. So you guys are agile also.
We are. It's amazing.
So what are some of the new things in 2.0 that MEF developers out there are stoked about, are going to be stoked about?
Well, I'm going to be stoked about, I'm sure. So there is, and Kevin will correct me, because this release has been, as I think I said it before, it's largely reactive. We collected a lot of feedback from the version 1, and Visual Studio provided us some feedback, and our customers out there, especially with our releases on CodePlex, it allowed us to release features, test them out, maybe pull them back, and all of that. And so a lot of those are sort of the expansion of existing scenarios and quality of life changes. One bit of feedback that's been given to us is that the hosting of applications that based on MEF is relatively complex. And again, given that we have tried to satisfy a lot of Visual Studio scenarios, some of which are incredibly difficult, incredibly complex and involved, the hosting APIs were not in the V1 designed to be extremely simple. And so we have invested a little bit into making sure that simple apps are actually relatively simple to bootstrap. Now, I don't think we're quite done with it yet, but we are sort of on our way there. Another thing, which is completely unrelated to any of this, was our default programming model, attribute-based programming model, when you annotate types with imports and export attributes. One of the things that people have asked us about is to support open generics. Which, I mean, open generics existed in C# and in the runtime of since V2, and yet MEF didn't provide any exposure for them. And so we did that. It was a big chunk of work which the side effect of which open generics work, basically, pretty much in the same way you would expect them to. Another bit of feedback we've been given is that if you wanted to, and it's a kind of a, on the sort of a complex scenario side, if you wanted to create a more complex apps which have a hierarchy of, as we call them, containers. The good way of thinking about it is you think about Visual Studio, mm-hmm. and you think about the shell itself and functionality that exposes it at the wide level, like ability to pop up a message box within Air or customize properties, that sort of thing. And then you can think about project-specific functionality, you know, being able to compile, deploy, configure properties of the project. And then you can think of editor-specific functionality, which involves syntax highlighting and all of that stuff. And all of the done, there's a stream, or rather a sequence of contexts, because you would have a different highlighting in C-sharp as you would have in VB. Mm-hmm. So you can think about it as basically, as we call scopes, as a chain of inherited scopes, where you would create a new scope of an editor within the scope of a project, and that would be customized by the project. Now, we actually had this functionality before, but it was the way that you had to do it was relatively complex, and it also, unfortunately, required some exposure of the container, which we also didn't want you to have, because it's harmful for parts to do so. So I'm kind of getting into details here. But
no, details are good. Developers are watching this.
And so basically, the we did some work to enable this specific scenario. Mm-hmm. Another thing we did was, how do I characterize Registration Builder?
Yeah, so there are a couple of less glamorous things that we did. when we released version 1 of MEF, there were two fairly loud pieces of feedback that came from the customers. The first was, it's virtually impossible to figure out why your composition isn't working when it doesn't work. The ability to diagnose a composition failure was every bit as bad as when V1 of the CLR was released and nobody knew why their assemblies were loading. And the reason is probably exactly the same. It's almost exactly the same problem. So we've done a number of things inside MEF to make it a little easier to diagnose those failures. For example, we've allowed the debugger to catch a first chance exception on a composition failure that we didn't actually really need to throw an exception for, because it was entirely internal. So now you can actually catch the thing that's causing your composition to not show correctly, whereas previously you'd have needed the source code and you'd needed to stick a break on exactly the right line of code. Which, you know, maybe Oleg, we could ship an Oleg in every box and then you'd be able to do that, but for the rest of us, that's
a little
tricky.
It's very taxing for me too.
And the box would be very big. So ease of use, ease of diagnostics, we spent a whole milestone on fixing that and making that a lot easier. The other thing that we added was, so there are two types of people in the world. Those that like decorating types with attributes, and those for whom decorating types with attributes is the worst thing on the planet. And I know this to be true because half of the V1 team thought it was the worst thing on the planet, and the other half of the team thought that it was just like the greatest thing since sliced bread. And so with this release of MEF, we're building on a new technique that's been added to the BCL called reflection context. What a reflection context does is it allows us to write some code that will, at runtime, introduce declarative attributes to our runtime. It's a bit tricky to figure out exactly what's going on, because at the end of the day, you're just reflecting over some types. But we have added a thing called Registration Builder. And what Registration Builder does is it uses reflection context to allow you to write some rules, or developers to write some rules, that say, if, for example, if the type has the class name foo and implements an interface ifoo, then export the contract ifoo with some metadata that you can specify. So you can write some code, and the code introduces rules. The rules are based against C# types. You can then apply those rules to an assembly, a managed assembly, and what Meth will see is those types decorated with the attributes that your rules have said should be there, even though you didn't type those attributes when you compiled up your assembly. So that's useful for those guys that have attribute phobia, but it's also useful for people who want to use types that they don't actually own the source code for and can't recompile that source code with the attributes on. So in truth, it allows you to use POCO types with MEF and allow them to be either composed or to compose into MEF graphs.
Nice.
So that's the registration builder, and it's kind of cool. I quite like it.
Absolutely. And it's nice to see the relationship between reflection context, which you mentioned is new in BCL 4.5. We sort of touched on that as well with Mercia.
Mitch.
That is his name.
Right? He likes to be called that.
He likes to be called Mitch.
He likes to be called Mitch.
It's pronounced Mitch.
Mercia pronounced Mitch. You got it, brother. I can't imagine what I called him in the interview that I did. I think it was not even close to that. I think it was like Marson. Anyway, right on. But it's nice to see how the improvements in reflection have enabled this feature. And whether or not your requirement for this built-in kind of pushed back into the new reflection feature.
It actually did. It was very interesting.
Yeah, reflection context, we were probably one of the primary askers for reflection context. It also, the design for reflection context also takes into account where we want reflection to be in a release or two's time. Obviously, we can't get there in one lab. We have to get there in little bits. And MEF had a particularly strong requirement to be able to, at runtime, inject attributes to types, and that certainly influenced the design a lot.
So now, at the risk of being yelled at by .NET developer niners, because I'm going to ask a question about native code.
Mm-hmm.
So forgive me, guys out there and girls. I think it's just guys that get uptight about this, but I mean. In some sense, this type of concept of building an app that's extensible, mm-hmm. pluggable, and not just at the add-in level, but rather at the, you could see an app being self, evolving
mm-hmm.
through MEF and mm-hmm. the additions of this of these nice features at the code level. Why managed only? Is it a matter of resources, or is it a technical complexity, or what's the deal?
I can probably take a crack at that, if you'd like.
That's the question.
So the really interesting thing about managed code is that there's a standard way of describing what the shape of the code is, what the methods look like, what the interfaces look like, what they're called. With unmanaged code, with C++, you just get a V table. I guess you could crack open the symbol file and, assuming people ship meaningful symbol files. Mm-hmm. But in reality, the code and what describes it is very decoupled in the unmanaged world. Now, you guys went to build this week,
mm-hmm.
and you saw Windows releasing the Windows Runtime, which does have a rich metadata describing the unmanaged code and unmanaged code APIs. At some point in the future, it's pretty clear that we may well want to do MEF-style functionality with WinRT APIs.
In fact, they have exactly the same metadata format, which you can see by if you open any NMD file using LDASM or Reflector. Reflector might not go very deep in crash, but nevertheless, you will see the hierarchy of things. So given that it's the same metadata model, I believe we even did some experiments in the first iterations on WinMD when actually there is no reason why MEF wouldn't work against that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think Kevin pretty much got it right when he said that there is one, in managed code, there is one version of the truth. The code describes itself. And we have metadata tables which describe the classes and the types, and you can reason about that. In native code, you would either have to use dirty hacks like pulling things from PDBs, which is by the design are for something else.
Exactly.
Or you would have to annotate it with a manifest of some sort, and that is a second version of the truth. And mm-hmm. we have learned many, many times over that any times when you have an artifact and then a thing that annotates it, they get out of sync all the time. And then you have bizarre and obscure errors that come with that.
Interesting. I mean, the other question would be, in some sense, if MEF were a library
mm-hmm.
That you would use, you know, certain particular interfaces which would guarantee that this is a chunk of functional code, or not functional in a functional programming
mm-hmm.
sense, but a chunk of code that can be extended, or
mm-hmm.
it can be that this is sort of MEF code, or this is extensible code, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, what I'm trying to grab out here is that you guys do a lot of work at runtime, what I'm hearing.
We do some. Well, of course, because...
For the people who don't like attributes, people who do,
mm-hmm.
right, to solve the 50-50 problem. So for the native world, if you had a library where, you know, there were certain, like, MEF interfaces that I could use
mm-hmm.
in my
mm-hmm.
native applications that somehow expose me as a... extensible thing
mm-hmm.
or extensible, you know, construct for people to, I don't know what they would do to it. I mean, this whole different world. But it's easier said than done. Anyway, I wanted to just bring that part up because, you know, it's an interesting question.
No, I
That's
mean,
all.
And it's absolutely true. And actually, one of the interesting things about MEF, which we haven't talked about right now, when we talk about MEF, a lot of times we're talking about slapping attributes, import exponent attributes on .NET types.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, interestingly enough, MEF in its implementation as well as its public service is very strictly decoupled into several layers. We have a thing which we call the primitives. And the primitives are effectively, you can think about it as a sort of a reflection-like or AST-like model, which effectively describes what the parts are, what the inputs are, exports are, and how they get to get activated. And we call the combination, the full implementation of primitives, we call it a programming model. Now, there is one programming model that we ship out of the box, which is we would be able to read assemblies, .NET assemblies,
mm-hmm.
which have classes annotated with attributes,
mm-hmm.
and we will look at that as parts. But one can always implement a different programming model,
mm-hmm.
which can be COM objects or, you know, WinRT objects or web services. And we had some, initially when we were working on that, this is exactly the kind of thing we allowed for, and we still allow this.
Mm-hmm.
People, most of the parts out there are still types, but nevertheless, you can't have pretty much anything in the world to be a part as long as you support exposure of exports, imports,
mm-hmm.
and ability to activate. And then you implement your own catalog, you give it to us, and we don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Because our composition system actually is in no way reliant on it being a .NET type at all. This is one of the very intentional designs from the beginning.
Cool. So, I mean, like you just said, I mean, you just recited COM.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of the COM guarantees or the sort of the COM pattern. So, you know, the export, import, activate, at least in the WinRT world, modern COM, if
mm-hmm.
you will. But that's also, so that's great. Anyway, we'll now move on back to strictly managed code, but it's a good story because the, you know, when you think about the world of WinRT and Windows 8, it's really going to be a hybrid world.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to have applications that are actually JavaScript, C# and C++, as opposed to either or all the time. You're going to have a lot of and.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to have an and app that's also MEFable or MEF friendly, then you guys are going to have to support sort of the COM model and not rely on the CLR
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
managed code.
So we're already set up for it, and it's just a matter of getting some convincing scenarios and you know, implementing the stuff we need to actually make those scenarios easy to use.
Absolutely.
Because the key with MEF, if you're not writing the host, the key with MEF really is that it's basically slapping an import or an export attribute on a type and a property, and you're good to go.
That's really awesome. So let's talk a little bit about how this technology, since you're in 2.0 now, mm-hmm. how have you seen it used in the wild? Like, what are some canonical examples of...
Beyond our wildest dreams, typically.
Excellent.
Which is what typically happens. So it's interesting, actually, to compare the original conversations we had when we speculated and fantasized about how things are going to be used, mm-hmm. versus what actually happened. Now, we had one huge customer, which is Visual Studio, which we actually have a benefit of talking to. So they tell us mm-hmm. before we ship, so that's nice. But outside of that, the things that I remembered was, for example, in V1, we were talking about the fact that we focused heavily on being able to implement multiple programming models, and that's actually what we talked about in a second ago. And what we found out is people are typically largely disinclined to do so, mm-hmm. Really now seems very obvious because... when people try to do this, they realize that it's actually incredibly complex. I mean, it's basically every time you try to implement the full plumbing and properly exposing things, and you have to deal with things like multi-threading mm-hmm. and proper activation sequence and error handling and all of that good stuff, it gets very, very complex. So our answers to many of the questions of, well, I don't want to use attributes, or I want to use them differently, or some stuff like that, mm-hmm. used to be, well, implement your own. What we found out is that it's not an acceptable answer to have. And so, which is one of the reasons why, for example, what they call conventional model or reflection builder was implemented to support, to basically allow the customization of an existing model. That was one of the large chunks of feedback, mm-hmm. which I personally didn't quite expect. Other things that we realized, for example, was people were, because math is relies in many ways on the concept of a catalog, which basically describes the contents of the application. We thought that most applications out there are going to be relatively simple. People are going to have one simple catalog, one single scope, things are going to connect in there, and that's going to be it. It turns out that people actually prefer sometimes to go in a sort of a relatively granular and hierarchical world. And we always consider it to be an advanced scenario, which it kind of is, mm-hmm. but we didn't quite expect it to be quite as popular, because a lot of the questions we've been receiving is, how do I instantiate multiple instances of this while dipping it in the container if I don't have access to the container? How do I create a child of a container if I don't have access to the container? Mm-hmm. And our answers before was, well, your host should set you up for this. And then we realized that actually a lot of people do it. And so we need to make it simpler, mm-hmm. which is why this was a reactive thing for us to do as well. We also actually found out that some of the things that we thought were very easy to implement, like a catalog, mm-hmm. was actually not easy to implement at all, despite the fact that it has two methods. It actually was, I think I even wrote a blog about this for our 4BCL blog entry. People always made the same three mistakes all the time, mm-hmm. which result to typically an incorrect and non-performant implementation of catalogs. And all of this was surprising to me personally. Do you remember what was surprising to you?
Yeah, the surprising bit to me was how many people focused all their efforts on writing hosts. Mm.
There is that, yeah.
Whenever we were thinking about meth and thinking about meth scenarios, our primary focus internally was on making it real easy to make extension points and real easy to make make paths to plug into those extension points. The Lego part of it, mm-hmm. and it really did turn out that everybody was spending almost every waking minute writing complicated hosting code with, using composition batch and export providers and
that. Why was that? Maybe what was going on? What problem were they trying to solve?
So I suspect that the problems they were trying to solve that they were using math to solve were focused on how they would have solved it if they weren't using composition. And typically that's creating new instances of a type and, you know, setting some properties on it. And what they really wanted math to do was to fill in the details for the types that they were creating. And because we hadn't provided sufficient hosting simplifications, they looked at the knobs that we'd got, and we have many knobs on a container.
So they grab something that looks like it should do the job, and you go, don't, yeah. It's actually hilarious. It's very difficult when you have to address the needs of a huge and a very complex customer, which is Visual Studio, while trying to at the same time think about what a simple app looks like. And so the moment, for example, anybody out there says, so I implemented my expert provider, and I stop them right away and I say, why? They go, well, I could. I go, no, but you shouldn't. And then the conversation, but it's exposed that it's for very advanced scenarios. So it's one of those things. Actually, one of the things we didn't mention, we talked about what we did for this release. Everybody talked about, oh my God, what do we call it these days? The public surface of .NET for Metro-style apps.
Yes.
That thing. That thing that we expose into Windows 8. Mm-hmm. That thing.
The profile.
The profile, thank you. I changed the name so many times, I'm afraid. And I've been told not to call it certain things, and now I'm afraid.
Understood. You're okay. You're going to be okay.
So it was actually a very good forcing function for us to look at the mess we have created and to identify what we feel is the most appropriate subset to use. And so while we're absolutely keeping all of the existing functionality in place because of the backward compat and because we need to satisfy complex needs of various customers, the simple model that we're trying to define actually doesn't contain any of the knobs that people get entangled in and ultimately hang themselves with. Mm. So this was a very challenging exercise to do.
That's great. I mean,
so we do have going forward, we have a very simple hosting model. It has many, many fewer knobs. Many fewer knobs. Mm. And, you know, there are people, again, who would like some of those knobs back because, you know, they're kind of useful knobs to, for them to turn. But we've paired it right back so that people can actually focus on building extension points for their applications and extensions to add into those extension points.
Now, the interesting thing, since it's in some sense, the marketplace in the real world, not that the Visual Studio team isn't a marketplace in the real world, but it's different.
Of course.
So when you let this out into the real world, you weren't exactly sure. This is the case with lots of frameworks mm-hmm. and platforms and blah, blah, blah. You weren't exactly sure how people would actually use it. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this all over the place forever on our platform. And so the thing would be is the problem that they were trying to solve that you thought was crazy, has it been solved for them in another context, right? So you had mentioned why they were essentially using Meph incorrectly, or not how it was designed. The question is, were they trying to do that just because they could, or there was a real problem they were trying to solve?
So I think when they were using the APIs that they were using, they had a problem. They had a specific problem in mind, and they saw some of our knobs that got them closer to solving their problem. Mm. If they had reframed their problem a little differently, they may have chosen a different set of knobs. Mm. And I think the thing that we did with V1 was we didn't frame the environment in which they were working to lead them towards really focusing on imports and exports. And instead, I should think 80% of the APIs that we released were all around the hosting set of things. Mm-hmm. I just plucked that number out of the air, but 75.6% of stats are made up on the spot.
Yes.
Because of the preponderance of the APIs, I think it led them towards thinking that was the problem that it was supposed to be solved.
Great.
Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense.
If I could try to add to this. I completely agree with Kevin that we have exposed too much, and in some ways, and this is exactly because we didn't actually, because of our V1, in some ways we made a choice not to make some choices. In a sense, we did not provide pervasive guidance on what you should or shouldn't do. Instead, we threw out a bunch of features, mm-hmm. and we saw people using them, and that's how we learned. Two things that worth mentioning in this context, which we have, which are actually very indicative, are recomposition and rejection. Recomposition is, when we think about recomposition, it's adding dynamicity to the composition. Which means, for example, that you know your app is running, a new functionality magically appears from the air, your app automatically changes itself to, you know... While it's running, there is a new menu item appears, all of this great stuff happens, and it makes for amazing demoware. People drop in a binary, and all of a sudden, new menu item appears. It's fantastic. People love watching it, and people love the idea of it. And we implemented it. It actually complicates things enormously, because when you add dynamicity to the system, you always have the question, which thread of the updates are going on? And now you have to protect yourself against multiple compositions entering the same state. Now, of course, you have to make sure that the parts are properly identified. Now you have to expose the programming model. We did all of that. And we saw exactly this. In most cases, we saw exactly the same pattern in people using it. People will get excited about it. They will start using it. They will discover that the complexities of using it, not because of something we did, but because of just intrinsic complexities that come with it, at least the way we implemented it,
sure,
is extremely complex, because you will have your field or your property changing at any time, and you have to adapt to this. It's really difficult to write very mutable code like this. And after they went through all of this, they would go, well, maybe it's not an important scenario for us after all. So we always had the same, yes, maybe, okay, maybe not.
Sure.
And it happened with recomposition every time. Rejection was a very interesting thing. How do we call it? Atomic composition, I think, is the official name. So, or stable composition.
Stable
composition. Again, beautiful idea. The idea is that you have your composition, and again, consider something size of VS. And it's not about size. VS is made of extensible things, right? There is almost no part of Visual Studio that is the core VS. It's all made of things. Now, you just shove them all together and you pray that it's going to work, which sometimes it won't, depending on how you put things together. Yes, and the idea was you would like to preserve, add stability to the system, such that then the things that you add that complicate or break the existing composition will be taken out, rejected, and things that are sitting there and already working will stay in. And so basically, we introduced all these wonderful things which... It boggles people's mind, basically. We pretend that some... if parts cannot work properly, we pretend that they don't exist. Which creates a situation where people go, its part is over here, it's in my catalog, look, it's over here, why is it not showing up? And then the diagnostics problem that Kevin was talking about before was largely about the people not seeing that.
Interesting.
So, just to clarify the Visual Studio case, mm-hmm. Visual Studio is a whole bunch of parts that are extensible and pulled together using math. It's also possible for third-party parts to be introduced into the Visual Studio system. Stable composition was about ensuring that Visual Studio would keep running even if they introduced a third-party component that was broken or would otherwise break the composition without stable composition. Mm. And the way that the MEF chooses to do that is if it can detect that a component that's been introduced is going to break the composition, it removes it from the composition. Mm. Now, the act of silently removing it from the composition, because you don't want to tell anybody, because your app wants to continue running, the act of silently removing it obviously causes people a diagnostics problem, because now they say, but I added my third party colorizer to C#.
And nothing happened.
And the keywords are still not coming up bright purple. What's going on here? Mm. They weren't coming up bright purple because, well, we had detected that they were going to break the Visual Studio composition. And so we had silently ignored it. And that's a tough... It's a tough sell to third parties, mm-hmm. and to everybody, even to us. Mm-hmm. So...
It's essentially just catching errors and not bubbling them up to other layers of the application.
And carefully removing all of the dependencies of those errors as well.
That's really interesting.
But that leads to the fact that not only that you can ask for something for A, and due to the fact that a Z is broken, you do not get an A. Now, if you ask for Z and you don't get Z because Z is broken, it's at least easy to explain. But mm-hmm. if you ask for A after that, people go, I don't understand. And it's quite believable why they don't.
Now, but in the latest version, because, I mean, since you guys actually, the reason it doesn't show up mm-hmm. is because of a determination that you made in code, mm-hmm. some sort of analysis, mm-hmm. where you actually have to go down a tree and understand all the dependencies. You have all the information.
We do.
You know exactly what went wrong and exactly what dependencies are going to be hurt as a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can provide all that information up to somebody who can understand it.
And we do. We actually did it since V1. In V1, we provided this information in almost intentional, obfuscated way, because it was not intentionally, but it was so...
It was complete.
It was too complicated.
It was complete, but a little difficult to traverse.
Yes. It was deeply hierarchical, and typically it destroys people.
Was it as complicated as sort of like a nested, like C++ template errors?
Almost.
Like where you get this thing and it's like, okay.
First of all, you would get, I mean, it's actually...
So it's a super complex error.
Sometimes it's a question of arranging a multitude of errors, because you can have a thing, A depends on B, B depends on C, C depends on D, D is broken.
Okay.
What you really want to say first, D is broken. And then you want to say everything else. But anyway, so we reported all of this from the very beginning. But the main problem is, we discovered that in many cases, this is not what people want. People do want their apps to work, and people do not want their extensions to break their apps. But in a mechanism in which seemingly random parts of your applications get removed, is not something that people understand and prefer. In many cases, people actually prefer for the thing to blow up and just collapse, because then they will have a stack trace of the failure or a dump, and they can identify what happened, and then they can actually help their customers better, as opposed to customers calling them and saying, well, half of my app is not there, what do I do? So one of the things that we did in this release to address it, we actually have a mode for the container in which the rejection does not happen. Except an exception gets thrown, doesn't get caught, flies all the way through, and you see it. It's off by default, but nevertheless it's there. And also the simplified surface that we have exposed to the profile for Windows 8 actually by default turns off recomposition and it turns off rejection. So because we think for simple apps like that, it's actually much more beneficial to actually see those things up front. Because when people write small apps and rejection happens, it's mostly not what they want. Because sometimes they use math as a way of what we call internal composition, which essentially your app is built of small bits and it keeps on growing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much extensible externally. Rejection is almost always undesirable there. You actually want a hard failure.
Understood.
So this is one of those things that we have learned. And so we have also learned, and though we're talking about it from VV1, that one of the things that we're probably going to have to work on is more static approach to failures, in which we would look, because we have a catalog to look at before we run it, we'll look at the catalog and we can analyze it and say, this will not run, and this is why. And that way, I think we can provide more value than what rejection does today. But again, this is something we're just thinking about.
Well, that's great. I mean, essentially what you're talking about, I mean, you even used the terminology, compositionality, it by definition means that you have a system composed of discrete components. You remove one, the system keeps running. And that's guaranteed in a compositional system, right? Sort of, right? You can add and remove modules, it can grow. And with an extensibility framework, it's exactly what you're doing. That's what an extension is. It's a module. And so I think it's noble and admirable that you guys have actually, essentially, even you've had to do rocket science underneath the covers to ensure compositionality. You don't break Visual Studio because your colorizer doesn't work. I still want to compile my code.
Exactly.
I don't care what the keyword colors are. So that's admirable and cool. And people probably understand that that's what you're trying to achieve with Meth in general. And it will be nice to see as you guys evolve to, like you said, static analysis up front. To be like, dude, this is not compositional. Sorry, non-compositional error. And here's exactly what your problem is. So fix it and try again.
That's kind of that's ideal.
Nice, man. Very good work. Hey, great to meet you guys. Really,
pleasure.
Really awesome work. And Meth, I think, is super cool. And I'm looking forward to see how it evolves. And we'll come back and talk to you in the 3.0 time frame.
Please.
Nice work, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers.